Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Science of Sports Podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
So last week we started our first episode of our season on fatigue, and we discussed some of the details regarding fatigue and how it happens and some of the molecular and physiological processes that happen for fatigue. And we kind of broke down what fatigue really was and whether it was mind versus body, etc., etc. So if you need to know more about that, you can go back to that podcast, which is the one happening before that, the one we put up now. We'll probably get on to some of the aspects that we discussed last week in the fatigue podcast, because today we're going to talk a little bit about fatigue resistance and whether it is a term that is a newfangled modern term for fatigue or whether it's something that's just been rehashed and has always been around. So Ross and I are going to get into that in a few moments. But before we get into that fatigue main subject, we've got some caught my eyes. And for those of you that are new to the podcast, we have a Patreon support group, our patrons on Patreon. If you need to know where to find us, you go to patreon.com and look for Science of Sport Podcast. And we have a very active membership of our Patreon groups. And it's a chance for people on Patreon to ask us questions, to raise things that they've seen in the sports science realm, and then to raise it with Ross, who often sends an email out, responds on Patreon itself, and we get a chance to discuss some of them in our podcast. We don't get all to them all, unfortunately, because there are a lot of them out there, and we don't get to them as much as we hope, but hopefully we'll get to a few more today. So Ross, kick us off for some of the ones we've got this week.
Yeah, actually this week a hat-trick from Gareth D, who sent in actually over the course of the last 2 weeks. I didn't get to this one last week because there were so many, but I've put it over, and then two new ones. And I must say, like he said, I'm sorry for sending so many in. You shouldn't be, because it's awesome. I would miss literally 90% of these. There's one today that I would have picked up, but the others I'd have missed because it's just difficult to keep track. But somehow he keeps sending these really stimulating articles in. And the first one was actually something that was released via Zwift. That's the software that allows you to join a virtual cycling world. I think it really took off big time during COVID. And this particular article was published at the beginning of this month, and it is basically a call for research participants in a remote cycling study. So it begins here saying, fellow Zwifters, we need your help for a research study that may unlock automatic FTP detection by only wearing a heart rate monitor that records heart rate variability. So FTP, functional threshold power. It's quite an important metric to understand your training status and your performance capabilities. And what they're basically looking for is volunteers who will sign up and then share with them data, particularly heart rate data, that is recorded during 4 exercise sessions. There's a 4-minute time trial, 2 20-minute time trials, and 1 Zwift race. A couple of surveys that need to be done on cycling experience and your exercise sessions. And then provided you've got a compatible watch, they can harvest effectively your heart rate variability data from those cycling sessions. And then very interestingly, they're working on this concept that there are fractal properties in heart rate variability.
Explain what fractal is.
Have you ever seen those animations of either a snowflake or a coastline? And as you zoom in, the pattern stays the same irrespective of how closely you look at it. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
That's fractals. Similarly, if you look at a tree branch, the branch has the same shape as the tree, and then the branches off the branches have the same shape as the branch, hence the tree. And so it's just these repeating patterns. And the theory is that these almost never-ending patterns have some physiological significance. So the heartbeat, for instance, exhibits fractal structures. And so they reckon by exploring that, they'll have a unique way of evaluating human performance.
In other words, what they're saying is, if you wear a heart monitor that is compatible and you're part of this test, you don't need to do an FTP test for them then to tell you what your FTP is.
Well, that's what they're going to explore, I presume. So that's
It's much like kind of what Strava does to some extent, based on what the hills you go up and the speed that you go up and the heart rate that you display on your heart, on your thing. But it's a rough estimate, isn't it?
Strava gets FTP from power, like it's direct. You've got to measure power to know power.
Yeah.
What they reckon they'll get is, as you say, it's an indirect measure using the heart rate variability. And so that's why you'll do 2 20-minute time trials, and that's effectively going to give them your literal FTP.
But you can do that on Strava and on Zwift now anyway, can't you?
You can go in there
and do an FTP test.
They're not the most fun you'll have in 20 minutes on a bike, but yeah, that's, you could do
that. Well, there's the hour one you can do, which is
even less fun. One third the fun, three times the duration. And then a Zwift race. So I assume what's going to happen is they'll use the heart rate during the race and they'll assess the variability, and then they'll have some predictive model algorithm that says, okay, based on what we've seen, your power heart rate here, this is your FTP, and then they'll compare it to your actual FTP and then be able to say, in future, you can get an FTP without doing an FTP.
So in other words, they'll create an algorithm that puts all those things together and helps you. In other words, you don't have to potentially do the 20-minute pain test to find out your FTP.
Exactly.
Okay.
So it's interesting. And also they'll confirm this fractal thing. So I think why it's interesting, and this is the point Gareth raised when he sent it in, is that with tech, the opportunities, and actually this is a theme we will discuss in our main feature of this podcast also, technology has created the opportunity to get massive volumes of data. I mean, I sound like an old man, in my day, this was 20 years ago, when I was doing studies, we'd have to
You were only 20 then.
Yeah, that's true. We'd have to get... Thanks. We'd have to get 15 participants to come into the lab on 4 occasions, and then we'd measure stuff, and that stuff would live on a computer, and it was 500 data points per guy. If that's a big one, you know what I mean? And then you'd mine that data, and now there's opportunities to get literally millions of data points. Remember after COVID, similar thing happened where people were uploading their Fitbit data because that's just what they did. And some researchers said, here's an opportunity and we'll get that Fitbit data. And if we know that you had COVID, we're going to track how long did it take you to get back to your exercise routine, your step count per day, your sleep qualities and so on. And that was really interesting data, just mined that way. I saw the same thing happened in using Strava data and the New York Marathon and shoe type. Remember when it's still going on, the debate about the shoes. They worked out, some researchers, based on hundreds of thousands of participants in marathons around the world, that the shoes were worth XY percent. I forget the numbers. I don't want to get it wrong. But this opportunity exists, and it's really interesting because I think if I was now able to go, going back in time would be worthless. But if I met a 20-year-old self today who was weighing up what to study, I would not go into sports science without learning something about big data management and IT. Because
a lot of your job involves that at World Rugby, doesn't it?
I'm massively underpowered when it comes to some of the data. That's why, in fact, in World Rugby now, we're working with big data management companies to create data lakes that we can set up and then mine in future and try and relate mouthguard data to injury data to playing time data and so on. Because you've got, the name of the game now is how effectively can you collect and then analyze and find meaning in massive, massive data sets.
Yeah.
Artificial intelligence is taking over a lot of the analysis that gets done. So I would not want to be a young sports scientist now going into the field and only learning about physical on-site stuff. You have to have the capabilities to work with big data sets now. So computer science, IT, data science is, I think, essential. In fact, if I had to prioritize it, I'd learn that before physiology.
Yeah,
that's the point it's getting to, I think.
It's changed a lot over the last few years, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I feel honestly like a dinosaur sometimes. I have to ask data scientists to help with how do you extract and set up this and that. It's different. So that's really interesting, and that's an example. If you look this up, by the way, we'll share the link in the show notes, and you can find this article because maybe you're on Zwift and you fancy being part of the study, and then maybe they're still looking. So that's the first one. Mm-hmm. Then Gareth's second goal in his hat trick is something that he shared earlier this week, an article from the BBC. Effectively, it's the Women's Six Nations at the moment. And the England coach, Simon Middleton, has suggested a rule change for goal kicking. That's based on the observation that so far in this tournament, 46% of tries have been converted, whereas in the men's tournament at the equivalent time point, it was 68%. And that's pretty well known. Women's penalty and conversion success rates are way lower than men's. And a big part of that is that to kick accurately, you actually need quite a high power capacity, strength capacity in your leg. Because
so women's rugby is the same ball as men's game,
at the moment, the same ball. Yeah. And so what's happening is the relative strength difference between the sexes manifests in many ways, but one of them in another way. So that's why this is quite handy, because it's yet another example of the difference between male and female in a performance outcome. Is if I'm trying to kick a 30-meter kick on the angle and my maximum range is 32 meters, I'm kicking as hard as I can. Mm. A men's kicker is kicking at 70%. And so, of course, his accuracy is slightly better. Well, quite a lot better, actually. Mm. So what Middleton has suggested is that if you score a try near the corner, they should move the conversion in. You know, it's, for those in America, it's not like American football where a touchdown is converted from in front of the post. In rugby, you kick it from in line with where it was scored. Mm-hmm. And so he suggested that if you score within 5 meters of the touchline, the kicker should have the option to take the kick 10 meters inside to try and make it a little less complicated and difficult to kick it.
Yeah.
I would suggest that there's another solution they should explore, and that's to change the size of the ball. Excuse me. Because at the moment, the ball that women use, by virtue of the size and strength difference, is disproportionately large and heavy relative to their strength capabilities.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't only affect...
So even passing is affected, because a lot of men's players are literally taking it with one hand, able to throw it.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm going into a tackle. My ability to hold the ball securely with one hand and get an offload with a free arm is severely compromised in women, because they can't get the fingers around the ball. The hand size is different. So, so in fact, that's probably the metric of interest, is what is the circumference of the ball relative to typical hand diameter, if you wish, tip to wrist, right? It's way larger for women than it is for men. And so men can do things with the ball. The passing speed, for instance, would be affected by it. The passing accuracy might be affected. And then, of course, kicks. And that's true of kicks from the ground and kicks from hand. You'd get longer hang time if you could kick a smaller, I think, smaller ball. Accuracy may go up. So
one of the questions I have around that is that why does it matter that the women's sport and the women's rugby is different from the men's game? Because you're not trying to have a men's versus a women's game. It's not a competition.
Exactly.
Therefore, the women's game is slightly different stats, a slightly different gameplay.
Yeah.
Therefore, why not just keep it like that? Why does it have to have the same conversion rate as the men's game?
Well,
that's just the way it is.
I suppose you could argue it that way. You could also argue it that you want the product to be as attractive as possible. Now, okay, kicking maybe undermines that, but certainly the ability to pass in contact, offloads, fewer knock-ons, faster passing. If you could, faster passing means the ball moves faster than the players, you'll find more space as a consequence. So there are game aesthetic and appeal commercialization reasons where you might want the two games to look as similar as possible. When we've actually tried to have this conversation with women around reducing the ball size by half, you know, so size 5 to 4.5, that many of them rejected, saying, no, we want to play the same game as the men with the same equipment.
Mm.
The consequence of that is that the game doesn't look the same.
Mm.
We did a podcast a while back where we discussed a paper out of Norway on football, soccer for Americans, where they were arguing that if the size of the ball used by men was relatively the same as for women, it would be a basketball in men's football.
Yeah.
It would be heavier, slower. It would have major implications on the game. The goalkeepers would make far more errors. And so I think there is an argument to say that actually you create equality by giving them different equipment. So that happens all the time in track and field. The discus does not weigh the same, because if it did, the woman would throw it 50 meters, not 70.
Yeah.
Probably even less. The shot put event would be vastly different if the men used a 4.2 or 4 kilogram weight, or the women had to use the men's 7.3, I think it is.
Mm.
So there are other sports where this happens. I would like to see a trial at the very least in women's rugby to see if it changes the way the game is played. But you're right. Maybe
it becomes tricky, because then you have to basically build another ball.
A size four and a half exists.
Does it?
Okay. Yeah, it exists. Yeah. In fact, before COVID, we'd explored opportunities to trial it, and we had a whole bunch of these things sent us from Gilbert, and they're sitting there waiting, orphaned, waiting to be used. Mm. So this trial could be done.
Makes so that you can also get it down to the juniors game as well.
That's why they exist in smaller sizes. Okay, kids, kids play with a four, you know. So anyway, I saw Middleton saying this. Well, Gareth saw Middleton saying this and shared it with me. And I just think, A, it's another cool illustration of how sex differences manifest in performance. And it does, I think, offer opportunities to make logical changes that will benefit the game.
Yeah.
But I hear what you're saying, and I hear what they were saying. They want the same ball, but then they must understand the game looks different. Or you have to accept that the game will look different. And you. But I do think, and Gareth made the point in the same message, is that the women's game is growing really rapidly because it's actually a lot of fun to watch. The skill level, I think a lot of men say, oh, I've watched the Six Nations. I don't care now. I'm not going to watch the women. It's like it's a substandard product. And I would hope they, like Gareth said, some of his mates have given it a chance. And they actually say, this is actually a lot more entertaining sometimes than the men's game because it is still evolving and growing. So I think it's quite an exciting space. But I can see that you could actually accelerate that even more by giving them equipment that overcomes some of the challenges that they have because of the sex differences.
Is there any difference in soccer in terms of the ball size?
I honestly don't. I think not at the elite level because otherwise that article from Norway wouldn't exist.
Yeah.
And then the premise of that article is that you've got to make a smaller field and a smaller ball because of the sex differences, which currently aren't accounted for or catered for. So I suspect not. Basketball, I think it's smaller. And then as we've discussed in track and field differences. And then tennis. Remember there was a controversy we spoke about last year where the woman played with a different ball to the men at one of the tournaments?
Yes, I vaguely remember
that. So that does sometimes happen. I don't think it happens, for instance, at the upcoming Grand Slams, French and Wimbledon. So it seems a little bit arbitrary as to when sports governance decides to make changes or not. But I think there's a logical, rational reason why you would. And so for me, instead of tinkering with the law and moving the kick in and so forth, I would rather explore a change that has other potential benefits and just use that.
Yeah, interesting one. Yeah.
Anyway, then Gareth's third and final goal in his hat-trick. And again, thanks so much. I've really enjoyed reading these pieces. And this is another one that I will no doubt have more to report on, is that the NFL has just approved a helmet designed to reduce concussion in quarterbacks specifically. And so And just by way of context, when I say World Rugby meet the NFL annually, because as contact sports, we share many of the same problems, legal, player welfare, and so forth. And in fact, in 1 month's time, I will be in New York for a meeting with them.
Yeah.
And I'm certainly going to bring this one up. Excuse me. The NFL have invested heavily in helmets as their primary method of reducing concussion risk in the game. They've changed certain laws as well, based on where they knew concussion was most likely to happen. But helmets has been massively central to their concussion reduction campaign, and this is the latest initiative. And what Gareth was saying is, why only one position, and is there any scope for such a technology in rugby to reduce its concussion burden?
Yeah.
So why such a position? I think in this particular instance, and again, I'm going to ask them, you're going to hear this from the horse's mouth, well, but from me, as reporting from the horse's mouth.
Because you're there.
I'll translate the horse in a month or so.
Right.
The quarterbacks have got a risk of concussion that's a little bit different because oftentimes they get tackled and as they fall backwards, they hit their head on the ground. And the article that Gareth linked us to says that about half of all quarterback concussions happen that way. So what they've done is they've probably reinforced the padding around the back of the head to try and reduce that specific risk. That's why it's position specific.
Because the controversy there is that the brain bounces around in the skull whether you're wearing a helmet or not.
Correct.
So there's issues there, isn't there?
And that's relevant to Gareth's next question, which was why has rugby not explored this? Is there evidence around scrum caps? And there is some. These are very difficult studies to do. You think it's simple. Just look how many concussions happen in players wearing helmets or scrum caps and how many don't, and there you go. But you don't
know. Is there a difference?
No. So far, the risk per 1,000 tackles or per 1,000 hours of playing rugby is unaffected by whether you wear a scrum cap or not. Mm. The best and the biggest study to date in rugby came out 2021 by a guy called Keith Stokes. I'll put that in the show notes. And it found no evidence that the risk was down. Mm. There's all kinds of things going on there. So, for instance, it might be that the players wearing scrum caps are the players in positions more likely to be concussed. So it might be that your scrum cap actually is a flag for risk in the first place. And then even if it works, it doesn't look like it works because the risk's the same.
You know? Well, because you essentially, because you're wearing a scrum cap, that's, you would go into a contact situation with a little bit more bravado than you would
That's the second part. So the first part is, if I'm playing in a flank or hooker position, and that's most of the guys wearing scrum caps are playing those positions, that's the position who's going to make the most tackles, the most carries, and stick their head in the most ruck. So their exposure to risk events is probably higher. So I can't simply compare scrum cap to no scrum cap without adjusting for exposure to risk.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah. Then the second thing which you picked up on is, it's called the Superman effect in lay terms, or risk compensation in the academic world, where once you've got something that might reduce your risk, you take risks that you wouldn't otherwise have taken. Classic example is people who wear sunscreen are more likely to get sunburn because they think, especially if you get the wrong sunscreen and you go in there with a factor 20 and you say, I'm protected and I spend 5 hours in the sun instead of one, I'm actually worse off. Now, the same with scrum caps, as you've just pointed out, I might not take risks putting my head in places and going faster into contact than I would have done because of a false sense of security that ends up cancelling out any possible benefit that I would have gotten from it. So that's possibility number two. Mm. And nobody knows that. So you'd have to track over many years a player and somehow assess his risk taking, his risk inclination, and then try and assess whether it's very difficult to do.
I suppose the only way you notice that is if actually the incidences of concussion actually increased with things like scrum caps.
And there is some evidence that it does. The guy presented in Amsterdam at last year's concussion conference, it was one of the oral presentations, an Irish researcher who's now based out of Canada, and he was saying that there's a suggestion that it might go up. Mm. I've seen some
which
data,
would then support that theory that there is this bravado element.
Yeah. Or that the guys wearing scrum caps are wearing them because they had previous concussions. Mm. So I had a concussion 6 months ago, 2 months ago, now I put a scrum cap on, and we know that one concussion likely increases the risk of another one.
Mm.
And so maybe you wearing the scrum cap because you had a greater risk of concussion, and so you pick up that. Mm. See, it's a simple question, complicated answer. I've seen other studies where cyclists with helmets are far less likely to have accidents.
Yes.
Because have you heard that theory?
Same. There are some people who believe that wearing a helmet is actually a negative rather than a positive in cycling. Yeah.
Based on my experience this morning in the traffic, I would not get on a bike in some roads without a helmet on, because if I'm doing the safest thing in the world, every car is not. So no. I wouldn't say my risk of a head injury is all on me.
No.
That's the problem. Yeah. And so a helmet can't prevent a concussion. So I suppose now the next question is, why does a scrum cap in rugby, those soft shell ones, not work? And as you pointed out, the mechanism of concussion, it's almost like an internal injury caused by the movement of the brain inside the skull. So as the head accelerates, either rotational or linear, the brain moves inside and it hits the inside. It's like, best example I can think of is fill a glass of water halfway, put a table tennis ball, ping pong ball in there, and then shake the glass around. The ping pong ball is being damaged by hitting the inside of the glass.
Mm.
The injury is not coming from outside. Does it make sense?
Yeah.
So quite how the NFL have managed to get helmets that reduce concussion risk, and they really do believe this because they've now got a list of approved helmets that they've graded as A+, A, B, C, D. I don't know. Maybe you can have a soft shell around the head and then a helmet, and the combination almost creates like a torque dampening system that reduces the acceleration of the brain because it transfers the energy in the helmet, whereas a soft scrum cap can't do that because it's literally one layer. So maybe future technology and scrum caps will unlock a way for them to work, but at the moment it doesn't, whereas it does seem to work in the NFL. And I literally, after Gareth sent an email to our chief medical officer saying, when we meet them, please can we put this on the agenda? Because I want to understand a bit better, like, why they get it right and soft scrum don't.
Yeah.
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 So very interesting.
Because I suppose the question from there, from the question that kind of crops up, and I don't know whether it's even possible to answer this, but there's always a comparison between the injury risk in rugby versus American football.
Mm.
But they are very different games
yeah.
in the fact that in American football, they are hitting you hard, and the laws around hitting a player and tackling a player are a little bit, you can do more of that than you can in rugby. There's more laws yeah. revolving around it.
What is a great tackle in American football is a collision in rugby. Yes. And would probably be red carded correct. A lot of the time.
Mm.
And in fact, the evolution of the two laws was in part enabled by helmets because you couldn't make some of the tackles they make without a helmet because you'd actually your skull would be in danger.
Mm.
And they've banned things like leading with a helmet now. You get that's the worst penalty you can concede and potential what they call ejection from the game, red card, you know.
Mm.
Yeah, so you're not allowed to now strike with the top of the helmet, the crown of the helmet, they call it.
Mm.
But if they played without helmets, the way they tackle would have to change quite significantly. So there's an argument to be made that for them to reduce the risk would be no helmets. But
American football is not a soft version of rugby, let's put it that way. There's always that the rugby aficionados will say, it's just a harder version of American football. It's not at all.
Some of the collisions in American football are two players without any restraint. The thing about rugby is
I've seen some YouTube clips about the biggest hits in American football.
You get blokes get spun like a cartoon picture of a guy getting literally spun 360 degrees.
I suppose that's the entertainment value, isn't it?
That's what they love.
Yeah.
So... Yeah, I think in rugby, the necessity of having to bind in the tackle or the ruck causes some degree of moderation, control to be introduced that doesn't always exist in that sport. So it is, it's incredibly brutal.
Yeah, very interesting.
But both have, in fact, when you compare the concussion rates using the same metrics, they're pretty similar.
Mm.
And so both, that's why we meet, that's why we have so much in common. So yeah, I'm going. As I say, we've got a meeting with him in New York.
Look forward to your report back on that, actually, because there's been good stuff coming out of that.
Yeah, definitely will. It'll be really interesting. Yeah, and then the last one comes to us via Troy Squires, who I should actually introduce to you. You may have noticed, those of you who follow us on the socials, the IG and the Twitter, we've upped our Instagram and Twitter game in the last month or two, and that's not us.
We've raised the bar.
He's raised the bar for us.
He has indeed.
So you can find him at Troy Malloy. That's his Instagram handle, Troy Malloy. He's a mate. He's a keen cyclist, triathlete, long-distance runner, does some crazy things on bikes and mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And he's into marketing, and so he's taken on the social media side for us, and I think he's
changed our logo a little bit.
Changed that. He's given us design skills we wouldn't otherwise have. Maybe you would have. I certainly don't. I'm not going to pretend to be anything
He does what we don't necessarily have time for, so.
And in my case, skills for. So, that's Troy at Troy Malloy. So if you're looking for someone to do a little bit of social support, he's got an extensive marketing background. He's in marketing now. He's done... And he knows sport really well, so give him a shout. Anyway, aside from doing marketing, he sent me a link yesterday saying the Boston Marathon, which is on Monday, I'm not sure when you'll be listening to this, either is going to or will have awarded its first ever title to a non-binary runner.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw it, I thought of you because I know that you loved it when New York did the same thing.
Yes.
And this is sarcastic.
$5,000 to the New York winner, wasn't it?
Yeah. Sarcastic font in full force here, folks, if you're not aware. The nation. Anyway, you tell me what you think of it.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those subjects. I was trying to find out and need some of the stories that we read around the New York Marathon where I remember reading something about the fact that the first winner was then rounded down to the next winner as people then identified themselves as non-binary. And of course, this $5,000 prize money was significant because as you would expect, and as letsrun.com quoted, guess what biological sex the winner was? Of course, it's male.
Exactly.
So again, it raises that subject around why? I don't get it. I understand wokeness and all that stuff and being politically correct, but I don't understand why there is a different division because we know who's going to win it.
I think you'll find they'll say you don't.
Well, yes,
and,
I know.
But I totally get what
it's
you're
how you identify.
I'll put it this way. If everyone in the race identified as non-binary when they entered, 100% chance that prize is won by a male.
Yeah, of course.
If half the race identified, then it's a 99% chance, depending which half identifies.
And I think 27 have identified as non-binary for Boston.
So for Boston, a couple of things that I gather won't happen is I assume that they'll say that unless you've already registered, you can't now after the fact claim to be non-binary. So whereas in New York, it's felt like they were entertaining applications or changes in class after the fact.
Yeah, I wish I could find that story that I read about it, but I can't.
Or disqualifying people who'd entered but clearly weren't. But how do you know that?
Because
how do you, that's the whole weird circular
basis of what?
Argument that they've created is you can't challenge identity. So if someone comes and says, I am, then they are, right?
Yeah.
How do you... It's the same as the powerlifter. Like everyone can, that's why it's so absurd.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I've got to go to the press conference for the Two Oceans Marathon today. And I'm very tempted to ask the question of the organizers where they're going to have a non-binary section as New York Marathon and the Boston Marathon did. Just to cause a little bit of an interest in the very dull press conferences that they have.
Yeah, but then you're going to be the catalyst for it next year. And then when that catches my eye next year, I'm going to say that you're the root of this particular...
I'll tell you what I'm going to do. If I do answer this at the press conference, I'm going to record it just because I think it's, I want to just see what they say.
You can pretend you're from Napier or something.
Exactly.
That's an inside joke, folks. Okay, so why is it a problem? It's a problem because equality in sport has been a real challenge for female participants. Like even now... There are many, many sports, cycling, for instance, where the prize money for men dwarfs women. Remember when the first Paris-Roubaix for women was held? And, like, they were making for running their race, like a tiny, tiny proportion of what men were making. And I'm sure that that still exists in many races. In tennis, it's only relatively recently that the Grand Slams have offered equal prize money. In women's soccer, it was big news recently when women from the US were finally given the same salaries as men were, the same contract values.
Yeah.
So this is not even a historical argument that women are fighting for equality. What these non-binary categories do, and okay, for the sake of disclosure, Boston won't have prize money for this non-binary.
Which is very important.
In that regard, it's a little different from New York. So it's really just the
but
prestige.
But they do award first, second, and third in each category.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so there's a medal and there's a prize for it, effectively, not money. But the point is that women fight for equality in prizes, and then here is a category that is guaranteed to diminish equality between males and females. That's why it's a problem.
It doesn't necessarily take away from the women's category, though, does it?
No, it doesn't take away from the women's category.
It's not allowing a transgender athlete to participate in the women's category.
Correct.
Yeah.
They probably would. No, I don't know what Boston's policy on that would be.
Yeah.
I suppose now that World Athletics has made a call on it, they have to comply with that because they would need to be compliant.
Under that auspices,
So at least there's that. But that's why it's a problem. It's just a reflection of a social push that actually undermines everything that women have had to fight for in terms of equality, because there is no doubt that it would be incredibly unusual. It would require one of the best females in the world to declare non-binary and none of the top 20% males.
Yeah.
That's what it would take. You'd have to be a top 1-2% female entering that category and hope that no one in the top 15% of the males did it.
I think the winner of the New York Marathon binary section was just over 3 hours, 3:05 or something like that.
So it was a bit faster. But again, it wasn't
not high end, but it
correct.
Was quick.
And there would have been hundreds, if not thousands, of women faster than that, as worthy, except for the fact that they don't identify. And what again, the point is, what does identity have to do with sport? By all means, live your life the way you wish to, but in a sporting context, so that's why. It's not as overt a encroachment into women's spaces as trans women would be, but I do think that it's something, you know, and it's just a reminder of some of the issues. And on that note, actually, in the last week, there's a trans woman by the name of Dylan Mulvaney. I don't know whether you've seen this. And Dylan Mulvaney is now endorsed by a couple of big companies. I think Bud or Coors. I think it's Bud and Nike to advertise women's sports bras. This trans woman.
Mm.
And there's a video that's been doing the rounds. And I'm not even going to link to it because I find it like incredibly distasteful of this Dylan Mulvaney doing what I think is supposed to pass as women's exercise.
Mm.
Like prancing about doing... In what I can only charitably describe is if you asked an immature 15-year-old boy to mock girls doing exercise, that's what it would look like.
Mm.
It honestly is deeply offensive.
Mm.
And Dylan Mulvaney is now a Nike ambassador for doing that stuff. It's actually like, and it wouldn't even register. I wouldn't care about this person if it wasn't for Nike throwing a sponsorship at them. Now it's a sports issue and I care.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of thing we've gotten to. It's like where these... Like, this is, to me, it's misogyny. The first ever post that Dylan Mulvaney made on what's called day one of being a girl, right, is, I've already cried three times, written a scathing email I didn't send, ordered dresses online that I couldn't afford, and when someone asked me how I was, I said, I'm fine, but I wasn't fine. How did I do, ladies? How can anyone not find that deeply offensive?
Yeah, it's incredibly that's a shocker.
And I mean, we all do it. We've done it on this podcast where something slips out and you realize you're just drifting into casual sexism. You know, it's like it's hard to resist because it's societal. This is, Nike is rubber stamping that, and it's actually awful. It's awful.
Yeah.
Just anyway, for the record, Jacob Caswell did win the non-Bronny section in New York in 2:45. So that was
I thought it was a little bit quicker.
Yeah, I think the initial one was 3:10, but 2:45 was quick.
But remember, we spoke about our athlete who was, I think, just outside the top 10, and I assume thus not in prize money, running 2:26 or something. So there you go. Like, here's 5,000 for being genuinely mediocre relative to the best females in the world. And that's the problem. Like, it doesn't sit well with me. But anyway, that's not a fun topic, particularly the social. Anyway, this Mulvaney thing, I think, is like genuinely distasteful.
Yeah.
Find that video and you tell me if you think it's something anyone should approve of.
It's a good discussion point, but it also is something that we talk about it too much sometimes, I think.
Perhaps. But again, I mean, you remember
we both feel very strongly about it. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah, let's try not to.
Yeah, the science.
We know the status. We know the science. We know the status. So maybe we park it and we get onto we can talk about actual women's sports performances instead of this nonsense.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
That would be great. Yeah.
Right. So let's get on to our subject of the day.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So last week we discussed some of the basics around fatigue, and particularly around sport fatigue. Obviously, that's our area of focus, and we focused on the physiology of it. So if you need to get a bit of a deep dive into that aspect of it, we'll touch on some of the things we touched on last week, but this week we're going to get into something a little bit more detailed, and that's the concept of fatigue resistance. So I read a lot about fatigue resistance because it's kind of doing the rounds, and the reason why it's doing the rounds is because of people like Tadej Pogačar, who people are claiming has more fatigue resistance than most. That's why he is performing and winning things like Flanders. And there is stories about how the Kenyans have this fatigue resistance that nobody else has. And I guess my first question, Ross, is fatigue resistance a new discovery, or is it just a new term for an old theory?
The latter. And it's, in fact, even like an option C would be, there's a new term that's been given to fatigue resistance, I think largely driven by like some exciting data. We spoke earlier about the emergence of big data sets, and one of them comes from cycling. So in the last 2 years, since 2021-ish, I've seen a number of papers that talk about a concept called durability, which when you talk about fatigue resistance, I think is one manifestation of durability. There's physiological durability, and then there's performance durability. And that's where the fatigue resistance manifests as a performance outcome. So it's certainly not a new concept, and I think it's actually quite an intuitive and obvious one. But I think what's happened is that power meters in cycling in particular have allowed people to gather data, such enormously in-depth, broad data sets that have allowed us to quantify in a way that was never possible before exactly what fatigue does to performance, and that's where durability then gains traction. And so durability becomes the name of the game. Since 2021, a paper comes out in a journal called Sports Medicine. And in this paper, there's a guy called Ed Maunders, who's the main author on it. Again, we'll share the link with you. And they introduce this concept of durability, in which they say durability is defined as the time of onset and magnitude of deterioration in physiological profiling characteristics over time. So, okay. Lots of syllables. So it's the time of onset, and it's how long does it take, and the magnitude of deterioration, how much does it drop, what's it, is changes in what you can profile physiologically. So it could be heart rate, could be energy expenditure, it could be ventilation, or in the case of the durability in cycling debate, it's actually power output, performance capabilities, right? Mm-hmm. Now, if you watched the Olympics when Mark Spitz was swimming, guarantee you, you would have heard
70s.
You would have heard concepts around this. If you watch any marathon from the last 20 years and there's two athletes coming to the finish line, and one of them used to be a really good track runner and one of them didn't have track pedigree, you will hear commentators say something like, Kipchoge, okay, let's talk Boston. Helen O'Berry's running. So let's say Helen O'Berry's in, she's a great track runner. She had, I think, sub 4 minute 1500, one of the fastest ever, unbelievable track, 5,000, 10,000, speed. Helen O'Berry is speed. Mm-hmm. Let's say the woman with her at that moment, whoever it may be, doesn't have that track background. And I bet maybe you've even said this in commentary yourself, is like the track runner is there just sitting, waiting to unleash a kick. Mm. And now she's the favorite because she's got the speed over the final 800 meters.
I always think of Alana May and Dorota Tulu in the 92 Olympics, Dorota Tulu was the one with the finishing kick, and Alana May was the one who was the person just trying to basically hurt her legs so that she couldn't out sprint her.
So even before you knew about theories of durability and fatigue resistance, you knew that one of those athletes had to do something to try and blunt the other one, right? You just know it. You watch a swimming event, women's 400-meter freestyle. One of them's coming down from 800, one of them's coming up from 200. The 800 swimmer has an obligation to make it hard so that the 200 swimmer can't access that specialty at the finish, right? Makes sense.
Yeah.
El Guerrouj, when he was running on the track, he was a 1500-meter world record holder, went up to 5,000. If you let the pace drift in a 5,000, he was 100% of the time beating you. Because in the last two laps, he was just the best ever at 1500, and you've effectively teed him up. So everyone knew that they had to go hard from 6-7 laps out. They often didn't. Easier said than done. And the whole premise there is that someone can have unbelievable speed over 1 minute, 400 meters, 5 minutes, 2 kilometers, whatever it is, when they are fresh. But how well they can access that when they are fatigued is the concept of durability.
Okay.
So that does that help with understanding what it means?
Yeah. All right. I'll let you finish because I've got a couple of questions I want to
ask. Okay, so I'll finish in 2 sentences. Yeah. So when we talk about cycling, for instance, because we'll give data from power output, there are cyclists whose ability to produce power for 1 minute is top 5% in the world. They are the sprinters of the peloton. After 4 hours of riding on a tough course, they can only access 95% of that capacity, which would allow someone who's normally at 96% of them, but who can access all of it, to beat them in a sprint. Make sense?
Yes.
So the one sprinter, the one cyclist has higher durability because no matter how fatigued they are closer to their fresh baseline. The other cyclist has worse durability because they drop off more as they accumulate fatigue over time. And so there's a tactical outcome that then would have to be almost respected here. Like you've got to expose. If you believe that a rival has a lack of durability, you know exactly how to expose it. So that's what durability means.
Do we know, and this, again, this is an open-ended question, that there are obviously athletes that don't have a kick, and there are athletes that can maintain a high speed.
Mm.
And sometimes do we know that athletes that have a relatively high finishing kick don't necessarily have the speed that somebody who doesn't have a finishing kick goes from that? And does that apply to endurance sport in general? In other words, does the long dice, if done well enough, always beat the sprinter? Or does the sprinter always have a chance of maintaining?
No, the sprinter's always got a chance, especially in the elites, because and this is where we'll go with this, is that the very best cyclists have unbelievably good durability. They drop off very little, no matter how much fatigue they accumulate. So if you look at them fresh, and you look at them after, say, 4,000 kilojoules worth of work, which is a ton, we'll get to exactly how you measure that in a moment, their performance relative to their own fresh maximum is really, really good. For example, and let's talk studies. In 2022, a study came out, Mateo March, who's one of the Spanish physiologists working with Spanish cycling, so they get access to their Spanish pro teams, found, for instance, that a world tour cyclist can maintain the same 1 and 5 minute power outputs even after 45 kilojoules per kilogram's worth of work. And that with, to get to that level, you're talking 4 hours of pretty hard racing and then a 1 minute sprint at the end. They can access the same power then as they do when they're at the start of the day.
So I mean, it's remarkable. Is it not just different muscles?
Not between the pro cyclist who can do that. Whereas when you look at a pro tour cyclist, so remember that's sort of tier two, you get world tours, now they're top of the pops.
Yeah.
And then your pro tour guys, the data from Mateo Mas shows that after 45 kilojoules per kilogram, and again, park that, I'll tell you how we work this out in a moment, they drop by 2.5% after that in their 1 minute effort. Their 5 minute effort drops by 1.3%. Their 60 minute effort is almost 3% lower after accumulating significant fatigue, whereas the world tour guys only 1% lower.
Right.
So everyone's vulnerable to fatigue, but what this data is coming out shows us is that the very best of the best, the category one guy, the even, excuse me, long COVID, even within, only half joking, even within the world tour, you get the guys who are your category A, you know, the top performing guys, they drop off less than the guys who are category B, if you wish, the ones who earn fewer points on the pro tour. So what it's saying is that the distinguishing feature sometimes, and this is what's really interesting, is when you assess world tour and pro tour, category A and B, climbers or sprinters, in a fresh state, they don't look different. That's what's really interesting. So the best guys, Vingegaard, Pogacar, Evenepoel and Roglic, let's say, they're the top four at the moment, GC guys, right? Grand Tour guys. Mm. In a fresh state, they don't look really all that much different to what a lot of second tier guys look.
Yeah.
The difference is after the fourth hour of cycling, their ability to reproduce the same as near max performances over 1 minute, 5 minutes, 20 minutes. That's what makes the difference.
Okay.
So that's the key thing. So some of it is muscle. So why is Van der Poel and Van Aert the sprinter guys at the end of a cobbled classic, and Pogacar knows he can't bring them to the finish? It's because they've got fast twitch muscle fibers and biochemistry and neurological systems that allow them to just generate more power over 30 seconds than he ever can. Mm. But he also understands that if he makes it so hard that he drags them to the finish, that's where his best chance is. Because even though his normal 30 per second power might be 100 watts less, he can make them pay 105 watts and he only pays one. And then he beats them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah.
It's the same thing in the Boston Marathon. Like, if you know you've got a really fast 10K athlete, you can't let the pace drift, because what you really have to do is hurt that person. The problem is you hurt yourself too.
Yes. So what's interesting, I did an interview with Annemiek van Vleuten, of course, the Olympic champion, the world champion, and probably, in fact, at the moment, number one ranked cyclist, women's cyclist in the world at the moment. And one of the things I asked her is that she was very, you know, she's famous for doing a lot of mileage. I think she did 32,000 kilometers in training in 2022. And she said, well, that's true, because as she's got older, she's had to do more training to stimulate the body to build and react. And she said for her that a hard race is better, is easier for her to win. So the more the endurance levels, in other words, stage races and hard single day races are definitely suited better, because she has what she believes is the ability to be able to have more fatigue resistance. Mm. Whereas a more tactical race and single day races that are not hard, she finds it harder because she doesn't have that absolute sprint that the younger athletes have. So she's a prime example of somebody that has developed into a rider where fatigue resistance is almost a skill and actually part of her armory.
Yeah.
And that might be based on the fact that she is 40 years of age and she just got so much training behind her.
So this is, in terms of like quantifying it, once you've quantified it, because as I say, the concept is fairly intuitive, and coaches and commentators and athletes themselves would have understood, you know, like, I've got to do something to load fatigue on, because fatigue is going to cost them more than me. That's how I beat the fast athlete. But now the power data is what I think has allowed quantification. And because you can quantify it, there's like new questions. Well, one of those questions is what determines durability. So just to take a step back, if durability is defined as your ability to reproduce the same or similar power outputs in a fatigued state as a fresh state, then Van Vleuten has recognized that her durability is one of her key competitive advantages.
Correct.
And so it's funny, because like, she would almost say, You know, some people would say fatigue is the great equalizer. You know, you can't judge at the end of a marathon who's going to win that sprint. But for some people, fatigue isn't the equalizer. It's the thing that blows it out. So she's one of those who actually wants to use fatigue to open the gap.
Correct.
And someone like maybe a Capecchi or Demi Vollering wants to use fatigue, wants to minimize fatigue to minimize that gap, knowing they can beat her at the end of a short stage where they've sat in the wheels for the day. It makes sense, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So now the question is, well, why do some people have durability that others don't?
Mm.
And there's no doubt the training load must be one of the factors. Interesting study came out of a group, actually with some South African connections, Duran Swartz on the paper, a guy called James Sprague. And what they did was they had a squad of cyclists that they monitored over a competitive season. They were under 23 professionals. So young guys, 23, under 23. And they looked at their durability early to mid to late season. Now, maybe worth pausing to just explain what the data looks like. When you have a cyclist, a pro cyclist, who's doing 6 or 7 races every couple of months and training sessions, 700-800K a week in a normal week, you can measure what's the highest power output you saw for 5 seconds, for 30 seconds, for 1 minute, for 2 minutes. And that's basically your record power output profile or your maximum power outputs and so forth. What you can then do is you can say, all right, when this person had done less than 1,000 kilojoules of work, this is what their curve looked like. If you guys are on Strava or you use Garmin or Wahoo, whichever, you'll have a power curve that you would have seen in your software. You've seen yours, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. That's the power curve that we're talking about here. So for instance, just out of interest, to give you some, this is a really cool study by Valenzuela et al., where they had access to hundreds of cyclists and literally hundreds of thousands of training sessions. To be in the top 10% in the professional peloton, you need to produce about 14 watts per kilogram for 10 seconds. That's the peak power for 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
For 5 minutes, it's 6.5 watts a kilo. So you work out, I mean, what was that, 600 odd watts for you for 5 minutes?
Yes.
It's like scary numbers. For 20 minutes, it's 5.5 watts, puts you in the top 10%. 6 watts puts you in the top 2%. Then you're on Pogacar's and Roglic's and Vingegaard's wheel, right? 60 minutes is 4.7 watts. To be in the peloton in the last 10%, like for instance, your 5 minute power needs to be 7.6 watts per kilogram. What I've just given you now is the bottom 10%.
Mm-hmm.
To be in the top 10%, 7.6 watts per kilogram. That's the 90th percentile. So you can see, like, so the bottom 5%, 10%, 6.5 watts a kilo. The top 10%, 7.6 watts a kilo.
Sure.
What they're doing.
That's a significant difference, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's the difference between, that's on Flash Vallon on Wednesday. Yeah. That's the difference between coming around that last bend in the first five versus being the guy shelled off at the bottom of the climb.
Absolutely,
right? So yeah, and then 20-minute watts is 6.6 watts a kilo for the top 10% and 5.5 for the bottom 10. Over 60 minutes, it's 4.7 at the back and 5.8 at the front. I mean, that's huge numbers, just enormous numbers. So basically, the top 10% of the professional peloton are doing for 60 minutes what the bottom 10% are doing for about 15 minutes.
Hmm.
So you see how it's...
That's why you've got teams.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So you want one guy to say, okay, you can do 5 minutes at 6.5 watts a kilo. You go. And then someone else will take over who can do it for 10 minutes. And then eventually I'll take over and finish the job.
Yeah.
So what they've done is they've made these power curves. But then they've said, all right, well, let's do a new power curve that's only relevant after 2,000 kilojoules worth of work. Now, in terms of this work, if you cycled at 250 watts, you do 900 kilojoules in 1 hour. That's because a watt, remember, a watt is a joule per second.
Yeah.
So 250 watts equals 250 joules every second, which means 0.25 joules every second, kilojoules every second, times that by 60, times that by 60, 900.
Right.
So they'll say, for instance...
I'll assume you're right on that.
No, it's verified. So 3,000 kilojoules would be the equivalent of riding for 3.5 hours at 250 watts. Then let's see what you can do for 1 minute, for 5 minutes, for 20 minutes, for 1 hour. And that's what's happened here. They've done these analyses. So in this particular study by Sprague et al., they looked at that early season, mid-season, late season. What they found was that
can I try and predict it?
Yeah.
I would suggest that the fatigue resistance gets better the more the later in the season, purely because they are fitter and more miles than them. So I'm going to project it that way.
And you would be wrong. It's the other way around. Okay. It's the other way around. So this is where it's interesting, right? So what they found is that the power outputs at any duration are lower later in the season than they were in the beginning. So the durability, the drop from a fresh to fatigued during a 12-minute maximal test. So they used a 12-minute test in this one. So fresh, you produce, let's say, 350 watts. Fatigue, 340. End of the season, it drops more. So the drop from fresh to fatigued was higher late than early season. And the reason for that, they reckon in the paper, is because your training state, the nature of your load changes over the course of the season, such that you move away from doing slower, longer rides and you do more high intensity stuff. So the argument that they made in this paper, called the relationship between training characteristics and durability in professional cyclists, is that lower intensity training probably helps with durability more than the high intensity work does.
Okay.
Yes. Remember we discussed a while back the concept of polarized training. The more polarized your training got in this particular study, the better your durability appeared. So the
because you were focusing on those long, slow rides. What Annemiek van Vleuten does a lot of.
Bit, right? So I'll read to you that the fatigued power profile varies throughout a competitive season. The difference between fresh and fatigued is not fixed. A tendency towards polarized training intensity distribution is associated with an improvement in fatigue power profile. So the more you polarize it, so you keep doing your high intensity stuff. Like, let's simplify, it's three zones: high intensity, moderate, low. If you start middle loading it, so that you do more middle stuff, your durability might come down. And so they were arguing in this paper that that seems to be one of the things associated with it. So that's one theory for it.
So one theory is that more base miles improves fatigue resistance, which I suppose... So then you could argue that people like Pogacar are maybe doing more base miles than most, if that theory is correct.
Look, there's going to be a massive genetic component to it as well.
I'm reaching here.
There are some people who just have it, maybe. That's the other thing. So just in terms of the finding, a significant relationship was found between training time below the first ventilatory threshold. Now, we covered all these thresholds in a previous part. I don't want to rehash that. But basically, think about that as your lower intensity training zone. So the more time you spend below that first threshold, i.e. in lower intensity, the greater your improvements in power output over 2 minutes and a shift towards polarized intensity distribution and improvements in absolute and relative 12-minute maximal power. So more training low and so later in the season, when your training time is compromised by race participation, races force you into higher intensity periods more often, your durability actually goes down. So that's why, in fact, that's why it's probably not possible to maintain a level of performance from the first race of the season to the end of the season. That's why no one's going to be competitive in three Grand Tours. And in fact, even two consecutive ones. No one's winning a Giro and a Tour. Or Tour and a Vuelta may be a little bit more possible. But anyway, there's models now that explain this.
What's interesting about that is a lot of riders will tell you, and I think this applies a lot of it to cycling. I haven't heard about it in running before, but in cycling, they talk about like racing to get fit and how cyclists will go into a season a little bit undertrained and use the race weekends to get fit. But this kind of flies in the face of that. That's saying that the way that you can actually improve your fitness is to reduce that intensity. And for a pro rider, those little gaps between the races would probably be better for them to do low intensity work than it would be to do high intensity work, purely because that's going to give them the physiological benefit across pretty much everything, not only fatigue resistance, but also absolute power.
Yeah, and remember we discussed that when we spoke about polarized training, is that there's a tendency to want to like expose yourself to the demand, and you actually don't have to. You might get better by staying below the race demand. You say, okay, I want to be really good at 5-minute efforts. You don't have to go out and do 5-minute efforts all the time. Because remember, the low intensity training is stimulating the same physiological, metabolic, biochemical adaptations. What you still need the high intensity training for, I think, are those neurological adaptations and for some of the biochemistry at the top end when I'm trying to go, 7-8 watts a kilogram for those 5 to 7 minute efforts.
Yeah.
the attacking and like the shifts in pace that are required on a climb. You still have to practice the neurological exposure, but you don't need much of that. What you do need a lot of is just volume at low intensity. So,
and we've done podcasts on this where we've talked everything from the experts talking about the 80-20 rule, 80% easy and 20% hard. And then there's obviously a school of thought that goes 90-10 now. And again, that supports that idea, which is often something we talked about a lot on the podcast, but very difficult for people necessarily to understand when they're training. And I often say the difference between professionals and amateurs is the ability to be able to train at the right zones. Because we know that we go out on a Saturday morning ride with friends, we're not going to ride zone two the whole way because there's some ego involved, there's a climb to go up. But the professionals actually do that. They go out there and they ride easy for 5 hours because that's what they're designed to do.
And when they're riding easy, they're still going 22k an hour up a 4% grade, and it's fun. Whereas we like to push because we want to go faster. So there's, that helps. You know, if the engine's faster, you can idle it at faster speeds. The engine's bigger.
So that's definitely the case. Is it a step then to kind of say that fatigue resistance is a function of low intensity exercise?
A little bit, because you see, there's a catch. There's always a catch with this.
There's always a catch.
A study came out, let me just get the date, earlier this year, 16th of Feb, so a couple of months back, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's published by Finnish researchers. Pekka Matomaki is the main author. A couple of them are from the Paavo Nurmi Center and Unit for Health and Physical Activity in Finland.
Sounds like they know what they're talking about.
And the title is, the title is Durability is Improved by Both Low and High Intensity Endurance Training. So now, okay.
Just when I had it all formulated in my head.
You never have it all formulated. That's the problem. So what they did in this study was, and this is maybe the main thing, right? And you'll be sensitive to this, I think, and why. In the methods, sedentary and recreationally active men and women completed either low-intensity training or high-intensity training for 6 weeks. For 10 weeks, sorry. Now, they define durability in this study a little bit differently. It's physiological, not performance. So they look, for instance, in this study, at the degree of drift in energy expenditure. So in the first minute, first 5-10 minutes, your heart rate is X, your energy expenditure is Y, your ventilation is Z. Over time, they go up at the same power output. You've all experienced that. Like if you only trained to heart rate, you would get slower and slower over the course of a ride.
Yes.
Because it goes up.
If you maintain the same distance, your heart rate would go up.
Correct. That's cardiac drift. And it happens for a few reasons. One is the loss of plasma volume. Another one is your body temperature goes up and that directly stimulates heart rate. Mm. Others are that you might become metabolically less efficient over time. You start recruiting fast-rich muscle fibers, which have a little bit more metabolic demand.
And there's fatigue.
And there's fatigue. Yeah. Well, that's actually fatigue is, right? Yeah. It's all those
But there is a, contributing. Muscles do get tired.
Yeah, so your heart rate rises in response. So in this particular study, they measured durability at the start and then 10 weeks of training later, they did it again. And what they found was that whether you did low intensity or high intensity training, your durability improves by the same amount. So for instance, I just want to find the figures for you and then zoom in on these here so I can read them. Energy expenditure before is your energy expenditure goes up 6.4% over the course of a 3-hour constant exercise ride. By the time you finish 10 weeks of training, it only goes up by 4. So you've dropped the increased cost by 2.4 percentage points. In the high-intensity group, it goes from 6.5 to 3. Same, statistically, same change. Cardiac drift, it changes by 2.4% beats per minute, before and then afterwards it changes by less. So all the physiological, let's call them perturbations, disruptions, are smaller as a consequence of 10 weeks training. And in this particular study, it didn't make a difference whether you did it at low intensity or high intensity. The high intensity one was like these blocks of 4 to 7 minute intervals making up 30 minutes. Now, so what's going on here is I suspect when you are an elite cyclist, you are already so close to the capacity of physiology that you are far more sensitive to a specific type of training. And what you really are looking to do is maintain that maximal physiological potential. And that's best done by high volume, low intensity work and not overtraining. Because anytime you encroach on training quality and you overdo it, you probably cost yourself more than you gain.
Yeah.
Whereas what's happening in this Finnish study, I think, is that they are recreational, sedentary, active folk. Sedentary or recreationally active. They're us. Right. Maybe even
okay,
less.
So they're not top end. Okay, right.
And when you're not top end, anything helps. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, just do something. Something will work. Mm. Whereas when you're at the top end, maybe your margin for error, not error, but your margin to see benefit is smaller because you're already doing so much that it's easy to tip off that peak, but it's not as easy to stay there. Whereas when you're only at 50% of that peak, pretty much anything you do is going to lift you. Does that make sense?
Like, yeah.
So that's where I think...
Obviously, the study needs to be done is using the same protocol, but on elites and seeing if there is that.
Right. But what difference do you do in an elite athlete to load the training on in a way that stimulates anything? Because they're already, you know, they're already doing so much.
But there is some stats there because you just mentioned that in that season study that numbers go down over the season for elites.
Yeah.
So... high intensity suggests that in elites, high intensity is actually proportionally bad for them, whereas for recreational and unfit athletes, any type of exercise is going to be beneficial.
So a couple of questions that arise out of that, and I agree, is the high intensity in the race season, the later season, the accumulation of high intensity, is that what's bad? Or is it that those minutes at high intensity could have rather been spent low, and so it's the drop in low rather than the addition of high that's bad? It's a subtly different thing, right?
Yes.
Is the high intensity training directly affecting durability, or is it the fact that it replaces low that compromises durability? That's something to explore. And one other point to remember with all this stuff, right? And that's why these observational studies where they do power profiles in hundreds of cyclists are cool, but they don't necessarily give you causal capabilities. Mm. Now, think about two teammates. One is Jonas Vingegaard and the other one's Wout van Aert in the Tour de France. Wout van Aert's job is to get Vingegaard to the bottom, maybe a third of the way up the last climb, and then to soft pedal in. Vingegaard's job is to do as little as possible for the first 90% of the stage and then take over and finish as hard as he can. So they actually have quite different race tactical demands. If I now measure Wout van Aert's power profiles and his 20-minute efforts after he's accumulated 3,000, 4,000 kilojoules, I'm measuring him at a time that he's actually not working as hard as he could because he's actually sat up and he's now soft pedaling to the line as easy as he can, right? Whereas Vingegaard, if I measured him in a fresher state, is probably not going as hard as he could because for the first 180K of a 190K stage, Vingegaard is trying to save energy. So I'm only seeing Vingegaard at a 10 out of 10 when he's fatigued. And I'm only seeing Wout van Aert at a 10 out of 10 when he's fresh and vice versa. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's possible that I don't think that undermines the concept of durability as it's been reported in these observational studies. But I think it probably exaggerates the scale because I suspect that Vingegaard probably has a slightly higher fresh performance capability than he's shown because he's never had to show it because they never go 20-minute max except for after 3 hours of riding.
Yeah.
Whereas Wout van Aert, his hardest efforts of the whole stage are often in the first hour because he's trying to get into the break to get ahead up on the road, or it's the first climb that he's going to be pulling the peloton. So van Aert's maximum efforts are fresh. Vingegaard's maximum efforts are fatigued. And so within fresh versus fatigue, Vingegaard is loading his fatigue more. So maybe he looks more equal. Van Aert's loading is fresh, relatively, subjectively, perceptually higher. Does that make sense?
Yes, kind of. But I mean, quite simply, Vingegaard is able to use more of his absolute power because he's less fatigued than Wout van Aert would be because he's protected.
Yes, that's sort of. But what I'm saying is, remember what the research has shown is that your best guys in the GCs, for instance, the climbers, have a lower drop from fresh to fatigued.
Right.
That might be an artifact of the fact that they never really climb as hard as they could when they're fresh. They only really give it their all when they are fatigued. And so let's give some numbers.
That fatigue is relative because for a guy like Vingegaard, he's not absolutely, he's been hiding in the bunch for a long time.
Right. So
and his relative work to a Wout van Aert
has been much lower.
Correct.
So fresh, maybe Vingegaard, let's say fatigue, we know Vingegaard fatigued is 6 watts a kilo.
Yeah.
When you look at his power output when he's fresh, it's also 6 watts a kilo.
Yes.
But he's never really had to go hard when he was fresh because he's in the peloton and he's sheltered and so forth. if he had to go maximally, like if you said, here's a 20K stage of the Tour de France instead of 200, maybe he could do 6.4 for that first, for the 20 minutes. And it makes sense, but he never needed to. Whereas Van Aert is often not going as hard as he could at the end of the stage because his job description doesn't require it.
Yeah.
His job is to go. So when you look at Van Aert's fatigue performance, it's lower, not only because of fatigue, but also because of tactics. That's what I'm getting at, is that it might be part of the magnitude that we see might be an artifact of whether you are required to go hard fresh versus fatigued, or fatigued versus fresh.
Yeah.
So that's something to just bear in mind.
And I guess what makes Pogacar interesting is that we see him often in, you know, not only monuments and single day races, but in Tour de France, making repeated attacks.
Yeah.
So there's always this question that he has the ability to attack, recover, attack, recover, more than most. So visually, he looks like he has the ability to recover from harder efforts better than anybody else.
Yeah, and certainly that's what they've said is the difference between him and the other guys. I mean, and San Milan, Inigo San Milan published that piece about some fancy mitochondria that I didn't really pay much attention to.
Yes.
But that seems...
That's Pogacar's coach.
Okay, so there's a couple things in play there. At an acute level, as in now I'm on the Poggio or I'm in the Tour of Flanders and every 5K I'm basically doing a cobbled climb and I'm going to hit the peloton hard every time. So I'm riding for 7 minutes and then I'm going hard for 1 minute and I'm basically doing an interval session. Remember, that's an acute issue. So what that tells us is that Pogacar can go above his critical power by a lot, because it's, those efforts up the Koppenberg and the Quaremont must be enormous. I mean, that's got to be huge watts, right? Way, way higher than his critical power that he could do for an hour. But then in the period in between those efforts he obviously recovers really well. Otherwise, you have two efforts in you, not six. And other guys maybe have one or two. It's matches to burn, you know, that's the analogy that we're
using. He seems to have more matches to burn.
That's what it seems like.
Yes.
But remember, that's an acute level. What this durability concept is saying is that his ability to do that after the 215th kilometer of a Flanders race is basically the same as he would have had you started that Flanders race right there.
Yeah.
That's the durability question. So that's almost like a chronic fatigue recovery ability, whereas the ability that you see on a short climb hitting the peloton four times within 5 minutes, that's an acute issue, which is probably related to, and possibly this is the mechanism, is when you go above critical power, remember, now you start to get that metabolite accumulation. You get the glycolysis and the formation of lactate, hydrogen, phosphates, depletion of your glycogen stores, etc. The ability to recover and restore that, let's call it balance, homeostasis, is probably what makes the difference between the best five cyclists in the world and everyone else. And I think Vingegaard probably has the same kind of capacity, and so did Armstrong, so did whoever was winning the Merckx and so forth, you know. Yeah. So that clearly is a requirement of being the top cyclist, is that ability to very rapidly reverse the damage, quote unquote, that high intensity exercise does. You know, it's W prime. How much of it can you access and how quickly do you recover it? That's your battery. You know, it's like I'm tapping into my battery.
So you're saying
it
is actually an equation.
Yeah, you can work it out. Like,
work out what that means.
For every second you spend above your critical power, you are depleting your W prime battery.
Yeah.
And at some point when you deplete that W prime battery entirely, you pull off to the side of the road. That's what the domestiques are doing.
Yes, they
vote for Nart. Remember that scene when he dragged Vingegaard away from Pogacar on the Hatacam, and then he kind of like treaded water. It was like a computer program restarting. And by the time Pogacar caught up, he was on his wheel. Off he went. That's a guy who's gone above critical power to the point of near depletion of the battery. Then he stops for a minute. The battery's restored. Off he goes.
So do you think, based on all the discussions we're having now, it seems to me the concept of fatigue resistance is really the critical difference between a good and a bad performance in every respect, in any endurance sport, whether you're a triathlete doing the Ironman, whatever. So absolute power, the ability to ride for long periods of time at low intensity, that means nothing. The ability to be able to produce similar, as close to your maximum power in a fatigue state, is the difference between a good and a bad performance in endurance sport.
Yeah, it's kind of like new goods. I'm new goods on the start line, and this is my performance ability.
Yeah.
Now I'm damaged goods by virtue of riding 120K or 250K, whatever. How much how damaged am I? That's what it boils down to. Yeah. And all the evidence from this power profiling, and again, with that fine print that when you do these observational studies, it doesn't always necessarily account for the tactical demands of your job description. But they all seem to suggest that the difference between the very best and the good, and the world tour and the pro tour, and the elite of the elite and the winners versus, I'm not going to call them losers because they're still, that seems to come down to your relative ability to defend against physiological damage. Let's call it that, right? And it's interesting, just going back to Pogačar, that stage, remember when Roglic and Vingegaard last year took turns hitting him on the Galibia and then he counterattacked and they threw in a dozen attacks, accelerations on the lower slopes of the Col de Galibier. That, plus the hard effort that he then set pacing up the Galibier, is probably what eventually undid him, because that was finally where someone found where this guy starts to pay in durability terms. That effort would have been so hard. Plus, remember, he apparently had a Haribo emergency of not getting enough sugar in. and incidentally, One of the physiological mechanisms for the durability thing, particularly after 3,000, 4,000 kilojoules, which is, again, is 4 to 5 hours of hard work, is glycogen and glucose depletion, liver glycogen and muscle glycogen. So,
but sprint power is not necessarily dictated to by those things, is it?
Well,
if you're Mark Cavendish and you're into the final kilometer of a stage, does it matter how much glycogen's in your muscle at that point?
Yeah, it could do, because there's a central signal, remember? There's a central signal, and as we deplete glycogen and particularly liver glucose that is responsible for getting the energy to the brain, that central drive is down. And so your ability to access power for 1 minute, and particularly for that 15 seconds that really makes or breaks your sprint success, might be compromised by central factors, not just peripherals. Remember, that's going back to last week. So if you need to refresh, listen to last week. There's a central component, as in how much is my brain able to put out to my muscles to activate them, and the peripheral component happening at the level of the muscle. So you're right, the muscle doesn't need liver glycogen and glucose for that 15 seconds, but it sure needed it to get there. And if you get there even 5% centrally compromised, that's the difference, right? And so so all those things are making a difference. So in the case of Pogačar, I think they exposed, because when he did that last climb on Col de Glandon, I think it was, and I dare say the same thing happened on Hartekam, except without the fireworks before. It was just a hard day at the end of a hard tour. He's riding at 5.6 watts a kilo. That's well below what he normally would be capable of. And so they've exposed a durability failure effectively through that teamwork. And so that's why it's interesting to see what he does this year. Does he learn to, because he might have spent 5,500 kilojoules getting to that point where he's dropped by Vingegaard. Next year, if he spends 4,500, he's not dropped this year. You know what I mean? So manage yourself for the first 4 hours in order to be ready to go.
And it's always a nice, an interesting concept to compare the sprinters of a stage race, like the Cavendishes and the Kittles of this world and that sort of guys, and compare them to the track cyclists and say, well, you know, these Tour de France sprinters are really, really fast. Well, compared to the sprinters on the track, they're absolutely nowhere in terms of the power they produce, but they're very good. They have to have some element of durability to get to the sprint, but they wouldn't beat a track sprinter in a track sprint because they are not necessarily designed for that.
Exactly. And if they ever found themselves in a race with a track sprinter, you know what they're going to do.
Although Cavendish has done both.
Yeah. He started and then off. Some of them did. I mean, like, they do. There's quite a good crossover. Wasn't Greipel a really good track guy as well, the old Quadzilla? Yeah. So, for example, again, referring back to that study, the top 10% of cyclists in the World Tour can produce over 20 watts a kilogram for 5 seconds and 19 for 10 seconds and 14 for 30 seconds. Wow. To get into the peloton, you need 11 for 20 seconds per kilogram. And so that's, for me, that's 1,000 for 30 seconds. Not happening ever. Now, the point is that an elite track cyclist is at fresh state better than that. But they're doing it at the end of a Milan-San Remo or a 200K stage in the Tour de France. Okay, the Champs-Élysées stage is pretty soft pedaling until the last sort of 48K. But you're right, that's the difference. And it's not just durability in that instance. because for Cavendish to respond to the attacks, to get over some of the smaller climbs,
yeah,
means that he must also have a pretty good 10, 20, 30-minute power output capabilities. That's what the track cyclist doesn't have. So, again, it's acute. It's what do I do in that moment, like with Pogacar and the repeated attacks. And it's the chronic, which we'll use to refer to the durability. Like, can I access this in hour number six as much as I did in minute number six?
Yeah.
That's the key for any performance. And that's why you can go out and measure this yourself. Like, there's two ways to do this. One is like that finish paper. Mm. Go out and measure. You'd have to find a relatively flat route that's not confounded by this hill, that hill, long downhills where you sit up and you don't pedal, and a steep uphill where you do 380 watts instead of your 200, whatever.
You want a 2% rise.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. So you'd want it to be an effort that you can manage, and you can say, all right, I'm going to ride 150 watts for 2 hours, and I'm going to see how much does my heart rate lift today, now at the end. Where is it now compared to the beginning? That's a physiological drift, which is a marker of your durability.
Mm.
Over time, as you get fitter, that comes down. That's what we've discovered training will do.
Mm.
The other way to do it is to try and look at your performance. You know, go and find, I think the best distance is between 10 and 15 minutes, you know. So that's a 5K climb, steady 5K. And hammer it, give it a good go. And that's going to be your 12-minute max power.
Mm.
Then go and do that climb at the back end of a 2-hour ride, let's say. An elite guy needs longer, you know, they're so conditioned that to induce durability declines, or let's call them physiological damage, we used that term a few minutes back, they need 3 hours fairly hard. But then go and repeat the same climb in a fatigued state compared to not fatigued and see what you look like, you know. Maybe you do 300 watts for those 12 minutes, and then when you're fatigued you do 250 watts. That's 50 on 300. That's your drop. That's your percentage decline.
Mm.
The goal should be to make that as small as possible. Mm. So you can apply this stuff quite easily. There's a paper, by the way, Peter Leo, is one of the researchers who's done a lot of this. I've never heard of this journal. It's called the German Journal of Exercise and Sport Research. And what they did is basically a 12-minute test, either fresh or after 150 minutes, so 2.5 hours of fatiguing exercise. One of those fatigue bouts was a constant intensity, 150 minutes, 2.5 hours at steady pace. The other one...
After the fatiguing part of the test.
No, that is the fatiguing part.
That is the
fatiguing.
So
it's a 12-minute test fresh. That's right. Your baseline. That's my 12-minute max capacity.
Right.
That's my ceiling, right? Now, remember, the durability is how far below the ceiling am I going to be after fatigue? Two fatigue protocols. One of them is 2.5 hours of pretty constant intensity riding.
Mm-hmm.
And then do the 12 minutes again. The other one is 2.5 hours of intermittent riding designed to simulate what it would be like in a breakaway. So there are periods of a few minutes at like 350 watts. There are periods of a few minutes at 120 watts. So fast, slow for like 2.5 hours. Want to guess?
Well, I'll guess that the second protocol is going to make the rider more fatigued, and therefore their numbers are going to be lower.
Yeah. This time you nailed it. So in this one, the fresh performance, 377 watts, drops to 368. Small.
It's not that big, yeah.
No, that's like, remember, these are well-conditioned guys. That's 9 watts as a consequence of constant workload, 2.5 hours. In the other one, fresh, 382, drops to 330. That's 52 watts.
Wow.
So that's the difference between a race simulator. So again, if you want to go try this, maybe don't go and do your 5 minute, your 5K, your 15 minute hill, whatever it is. Don't go out and do 2 hours of easy riding. Go out and do 2 hours of fast, slow, attack. Ride with your mates.
That intensity hurts.
Yeah, that intensity.
Physiology.
And in this instance, the 2.5 hours high intensity overall was a bit more work, and it involved a bit more time in higher parts. So obviously, it's going to compromise you more. So again, it might be that this is an exaggerated finding. But I do think any time you spend above your critical power, the costly exercise intensities is going to, you pay it back later. And that's basically the other durability analogy is it's like finance, you know, it's taking out loans and you pay them back. And the elite athletes just don't seem to do it as much. Maybe because they don't need the loans in the first place, you know, because if you're Pogacar riding at 6 watts a kilo is not hurting you anything like it's hurting, I was going to say Gordou, but he's actually pretty good. But it's like it's hurting your domestiques.
Yeah.
They're paying big time for what you're, I wouldn't say comfortable at, but confident at.
Yeah.
So you don't need the loan. And then later on, as larger loan, and then later on when it's time to pay back the loan, the interest payments aren't so high. that's the point, right? So yeah, that's what durability is. Is you elite, the best cyclists have zero interest loans. The average guys and the inferior ones, they pay heavily for their loans.
Absolutely. I know what it feels like. Professor Rostocker, thanks very much for your insights. Fascinating just to discuss some of the practicalities of that. And we hope that you've enjoyed our little two-part series on fatigue and not only found it interesting, but maybe applying it to the training that you're doing if you're out there doing endurance sport of any kind. But our next subject coming up in the next couple of weeks, we're going to let you know about that a bit closer to the time. But we'll be back next week. But for now, it's goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.